Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
What's going on, good people? This is PR, and you're now rolling with the winners on Winner's Circle Media.
What's going on, good people? I know, man, it's been a long time, but, you know, to keep it 100, I don't want to bring you no bullshit, and I know y'all don't want to hear just my voice, so I was waiting for the opportunity, a moment, to get somebody really, really, really special on the show, and I actually got somebody who I've been trying to get on the show forever, but... You know, when you're traveling around the world in private jets with, you know, elite athletes and double cheek kissing the Queen of London and shit, you don't have time for my little podcast. So, but without further ado, we got Omar Johnson, man, CMO of Beats by Dr. Dre. Oh, what up?
What up, P? are we really starting?
Oh, we're recording.
Oh, wow.
That's the beauty of this, man. What's going on, man?
All is good. Happy to be in Toronto.
Yes. I forgot to mention.
We are
coming to you live from Toronto, man. The city that has honestly welcomed us as one of their own. Can we say that?
Yes, sir.
Before we even get started, I mean, we're already started, but shout out to Future, man, and Drake. You know, last night, and they always show us amazing hospitality and roll out the red carpet when we're in town, right? But last night, Future gave me a call and was like, yo, you and O going to the game? I'm like, yeah. He's like, do you want to sit in Drake's seats? We want to give you the seats. And I was just quiet. Like, was that a question? Or, like, what are we talking about here? So, needless to say, man, it's their hometown. They could have gave those seats, which are by far the best two seats in the entire arena, to anyone. I'm sure they got a million friends, cousins, family. And they gave them to us. So that's love, man.
Yeah, real talk, Future. We appreciate it. Drake, we appreciate it. Like P said, y'all always roll out the red carpet whenever we're here, which is why we affectionately love this city so much.
You know, O and I were trying to, like, you know, show love to the fam, you know, Bron and Swish and the boys, the Cav boys, and but we're trying to be respectful of being in Drake's seat. So if there's such a thing as, like, silent claps, or, like, internal high fives, that was going on all night last night, man, after game three, man.
A lot of suppressed emotions.
Word. Man, I mean, look, I'm going to ask you some stuff that obviously I know, but, you know, it's interesting. Not too long ago, probably like a month or so ago, I put a tweet out and I said, hey, you know, I'm going to start the podcast back up and I'm going to reach out to some of my friends. Who would you like to see on the show? I assumed everybody would say LeBron. I assumed, you know, beginning would be like, hey, LeBron, Victor Cruz, blah, 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 blah. Surprised, but not surprised. There were a few LeBrons, but the most call-outs were for you and Rich Paul.
Yeah, stop gassing.
I'm dead ass. I can show you the tweets.
You and
Rich Paul. I'm not saying that just to get you on the show. Yeah, people want to know, man. Listen, people know success. People, you know, it's been interesting. The things people have reacted to the most is this, right? It's like successful people that have been doing it and impacting, influencing culture. So I think, like, my listeners are people that, you know, are grinding themselves, mm-hmm. trying to get after it, trying to figure it out, different points in their career, whether it's starting, whether it's, you know, they've started and trying to get over the hump, or whether they're trying to go from good to great. So when I'm able to have guests such as yourself on the show, you know, this is the stuff, like, they crave. Like, the most viewed, the most listened to podcast I've ever done is with Maverick okay. Carter. Okay. You know, so, you know, it just goes to show that, you know, the people listening are listening, you know, trying to acquire some knowledge, not just to waste some time, which I think is dope. So, but for the people that have been under a rock, we're 4 minutes into this podcast, but introduce yourself. What is it you do? Just for the person that's been on the rock, who is Omar Johnson?
Wow.
And that's a loaded question.
That's a beyond loaded question. My name is Omar Johnson. I'm a dad, big, big, big family guy. And work-wise, I'm the CMO of Beats by Dr. Dre. So I lead all of the marketing for Beats by Dre Athletic, pretty much from the beginning. I think I was the fifth employee at Beats. And I've kind of been the head of marketing from that day until today. So it's been beyond an amazing run. And we're still running. So, you know, it's funny because I get a lot of questions about, oh, what's next? And I'm like, we're just starting. You know, mm-hmm. we're still a pretty, you know, young and new and vibrant brand. And there's so many things we haven't done, so many things we haven't done across the world. So we're still continuing to kind of grow this idea of what Beats is. But it's been something that's been beyond my wildest dreams. And hopefully we can kind of talk a little bit about, you know, where I'm from. Because I think so much of that is kind of what's catalyzed a big part of what where I've gone and where I've come from. I mean, where I've gone. But what's important for me is when I think about what you just said about the people that might want to hear this is I didn't really have people like me to talk to when I was young. So as we talk about the journey, you'll hear, like, I took a lot of turns and there were a lot of dips and there were a lot of just unexpected things that happened. So I've been a little bit lucky. I've been very blessed, but it's been a pretty interesting journey.
A journey that's just starting, which is dope, which is crazy. It's crazy to think that, right? When you say a journey that's starting after all the stuff you've accomplished and where you've accomplished it from. You know, perfect segue into, I'm going to mention a couple of different periods in your life or your career, and you just kind of tell me what comes to mind. 17-year-old Omar Johnson. What was that like?
Wow.
Who's that guy?
Wow.
Where is he? What's he doing? What's he thinking?
17. I was in New York at that point. And I was a kid who grew up in Brooklyn. I was the oldest of two brothers at that point in time. I was the oldest. At that point in my life, my father passed when I was pretty young, when I was about 12. I was raised by my mom. So it was me, my mom, my grandmother. And I'd say that, you know, it was all these people in my neighborhood who kind of raised me. So I was in a really interesting transition because I was moving away from public school. I was in public school for all of my life. And I had a friend who went to a private school out in Bay Ridge. And one day he invited me out to go hang out with him. I went to one of his basketball games. And what was amazing is, you know, he was one of six black kids in that school. And he just introduced me to all these girls. All of the girls loved him. Like, every girl in the school loved him.
Now, was he the pretty boy? Was he the jock? What was he like?
He was a
or was
jock.
He just cool? Like?
He was a jock. He was kind of weird to be and quirky, to be honest with you. But in that setting, he was like the coolest kid ever.
Got it.
Right? You think of like Carlton and the Fresh Prince. He kind of had that kind of demeanor. But like I said, he was one of five black kids in a predominantly white school. So, you know, for them, he was super, super cool. So in my head, I was like, if he's cool, I'm going to take over. And I literally took my last 2 years of high school. I went to the school out in Bay Ridge, Brooklyn. So it was a really interesting moment for me because here I am, this kid from Brooklyn, grew up in the projects. And between a little bit of scholarship and a little bit of financial aid, my mom found a way to kind of get me into a really cool school. And it was a really important part of my life because it got me out of just knowing the people that I knew growing up. It got me into meeting people who were from Russia, who were Greek, who were from different parts of the world. So it was a really interesting transition for me. It's funny you pick 17 because that was such a crazy year for me.
Well, for me, it's like 17 is one of those you could just be starting to figure your shit out. You could be a complete train wreck at 17, you know, and I guess for most of us, it's normally a combination of all of those, you know. So first job.
I haven't figured out
First job. Omar Johnson's first job. Where was it? What was it? Did you think you made it?
Wow. I don't know if I had a first job. In my family, we got this thing, which was just hustle. We talked about hustling.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was taught, you know, you always, here, I was moving the mic closer to your mouth.
There you go.
You always have a hustle. I'm not quite sure why I was taught that. I think it's been an amazing lesson for me, but I was always taught that you have a hustle. So I always had a hustle. So, I mean, before I had a job, like where I had a W-4 and I got a pay stub, I always had a job. So when I was in high school, we didn't have a soda machine. I'd go to the supermarket and buy a 12-pack of soda. I would freeze it, take it to school the next day, and sell them out of my locker. I was selling mixtapes. When I, you know, my mom moved us to Atlanta, I started selling mixtapes. So well before I had a job, I was doing things like that. I think my first job was McDonald's.
Oh, wow.
And I lasted for 12 days.
Did you get that first check, or they still got it?
No, I didn't get the check. I didn't think I was going to get the check. Because I just stopped going. I didn't even, like, quit. I just was like, I'm not going.
When did you decide? What made you decide, this isn't for me, man? This isn't, you know what? No disrespect to anyone out there that's working at McDonald's. Just for you. What was that? Well, you're like, you know what? Yeah, 12 days is enough, man. I'm like, because if you quit at 12 days, probably at 8, you're like, this ain't for me.
Yeah. No, I think it's day 2. Because, you know what's funny? You know, every job has a hierarchy. And I've always, you know, I don't know what it is. I've always wanted to take the best job. So when I got the job, you know, the best job was kind of being a cashier, right? I wasn't going to be a manager, but cashier was the job. Or maybe you got fries. Like, I was the guy in the back, Like, I was stocking the freezer. It was cold. It was hot. So I kept going back and forth between the hot and the cold. I had to put the frozen burgers out. I had to get more burgers. Like, it wasn't sexy at all. And so, I was dirty. My uniform was dirty.
There goes my McDonald's sponsorship. They won't be sponsoring this podcast anytime soon. So no need to even call there. But you were there 12 days.
12 days.
Did you have to meet any good? Like, was it cool working? Like
no, I was in the back. I didn't get to interact with anyone. That was the problem. Like, if they just put me in the front, like, even if I could sweep the lobby, that would have been great because I could have met people. I could have. I really was in the back. And there was a guy who would yell at me. And if I wasn't moving fast enough, he felt like he could yell at me. And yeah, I think after day 2 and him yelling at me and telling me to speed up and I'm sweating, I was like, yeah, I'm good. I'm not doing this much more.
Oh, man. One that I know is very near and dear to your heart and not probably, but helped shape you professionally and maybe the way you see the world. Nike, you know, a lot of people may not know that you worked at Nike. Like, how'd that come about? You know, where'd you see the job listed? Like, did you, like, just talk to me about that whole Nike experience, how it happened.
I think we should go further back, because I think there's, my career has taken some really interesting twists and turns. And I think I'm, you know, at the young age of 41, starting to figure out why my life took those turns. So when I was in high school, I had all of these colleges that I applied to and they sent me documentation. So I felt like, wow, college is interested in me. I'm going to go to college. And, you know, the Cosby Show was on. You saw the whole idea of, like, what it looked like to be successful African-American adults. And then they had kids in college. This is before, I forgot the show that came out after, that was based in college. I think it was Hillman College or The Real World, something like that.
Yeah.
I forgot the name of it. But at the end of the day, this whole idea of college was very alive and real in my life. But I got all these letters from different colleges, all the colleges I thought were interesting. And they all had applications in them. And I never filled the applications out. I was just so excited that I got the letters. I never filled the applications out. I think the bigger story for me was I didn't really know how to finish a lot of things. Like, I was great at starting things and I was great at beginning things and getting exciting in the beginning. I didn't know how to close. And these college applications were a perfect example of just not knowing how to close. So maybe it's a week before college is supposed to begin, and this is in August, right before college is supposed to begin, and my mom's like, what college are you going to? So it's kind of late for my mom to be asking me what college am I going to, right? But
have your mom gone to college yet?
She had an associate's degree, so she didn't have a traditional college experience. Yep. So I'm first-generation bachelor's, right? Okay. First-generation master's. So, you know, she's like, are you going to college? I'm like, yeah, I think so. But remember, I always had my hustle, so I was making money, and I was okay. And I'm like, I'll get around to it. She's like, oh, no, you're not going to get around to it.
We're not going
to
do that here.
So she takes me to this school called Morris Brown in Atlanta, and she gets me enrolled. I don't know how my mom did it, but she got me enrolled. And they said to me, I was like, what do you want to be when you grow up? Like, what's your major? So when I grew up, there was basically four things that I saw that I could do. There was being, I was playing ball. I stopped growing in the 12th grade. So I was like, you know, not too much love for like a 6 foot anything in sports that I love to play. There was guys who hustled, and I was like, I don't want to go to jail. And then there was the Cosby Show, Doctor and Lawyer. I literally was like, I don't love reading a ton. So I was like, I'll be a doctor. And my mom was a nurse, so it just kind of made sense. And that was my major. That's how I chose my major. I spent 2 years at Morris Brown. Enjoyed science. Did pretty good. I was always like a B minus student.
What kind of student were you? Did it come naturally to you? Did you have to grind? Were you like, oh no. Shit, test tomorrow? I got a cram.
Yeah, like, that was it. I was like, test tomorrow. I got to work on it tonight. I was that guy. Like, I always had a natural aptitude, but I'd always kind of prepare late and last minute. So, you know, it's that word. Like, I used to always be told, you have tons of potential. Yep. You have tons of potential. Tons of potential. And I literally would wait to the last minute. So, was in Morris Brown. In a science program, and I started taking classes at a school called Georgia State, which is also in Atlanta. The facilities were much better. So I transferred over to Georgia State, and that became where my college degree came from. But I have a biology major, chemistry minor. I did an extra year, and I did a concentration in physiology. So, you know, get done with that, and I'm basically set to go into med school and take an MCAT and stuff like that. And the doctor said to me, I don't know if I see you going to med school. You should live with me for a little bit and work with me just so you can see what the lifestyle of a doctor is. And I'll never forget that because maybe 2 weeks in, I'm realizing there's no late cocktails. You're always on a pager.
It's not as sexy as people think.
Then he started showing me like his liability insurance and, you know, I did see he was making a lot of money, but he also had this really big expense base, and he had this burden that he carried every day of, I could hurt somebody, I could kill somebody, like somebody could. And I was like, wow, that's intense. And at that moment, I chose, like, I'm not going to go to med school. And I was like, Mom, I'm going to defer. I don't know if I want to go to med school. I don't know if it's for me. And you could imagine how disappointed she was.
Sure.
Mom is like, you know, you went to college, you paid your way, you spent 5 years.
And you're the oldest, right? You said? Oldest. So, yeah, so okay.
So, I'm the guy that's supposed to bring home the bread and retire her. And, you know, she was just enamored with this whole doctor thing. She worked with doctors every day. And I remember looking at her face and it felt like it broke her heart. And knowing my, like, the way my mom is, as much as it broke her heart, she was like, okay, what's next? Like, it literally, she just snapped and said, okay, what are we doing? And I was like, I want to figure it out. Did not have an answer. I'd say about a week later, a mentor said to me, hey, you know, by the way, I DJed to pay my way through college. That's how I paid my way through college. I DJed and I sold mixtapes. That's how I paid my way for all of my college career. Right? That's what I did. I went to college Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. On Friday, I was going to say, are you going to take that? Because I was getting a phone call.
LJ, what's good, I'm at the hotel. Where you at? You want to go over now? All right, let's do it. give me two. All right, okay. So that was just LeBron.
I was going to take that.
RWGW, the podcast, take one right now. And we're back.
Take two.
Yo, you guys don't understand what literally just happened. Honestly, on Everything I Love, we're here recording this podcast, like I said, at the Shangri-La in Toronto. And my phone rings, and it's, you know, the homie, LeBron. And he's like, yo, what's up? Let's do brunch. And we were going to do brunch later, but he wanted to do brunch earlier, so we did brunch earlier. Yeah, we did brunch. So we went downstairs, damn near the whole team's downstairs, all family. We went into the nice brunch like gentlemen, sat outside on the patio, enjoyed each other's company. Drank some sangrias. Kept it light, had a good time. Tried to do a little bit of shopping. That didn't work out so well.
Are your Snapchats dated? Can someone like research your Snapchat?
Well, we don't talk about my Snap on my show because some people don't even know I have Snap.
Oh, okay.
So. he's talking about I snapped and I would say how I hate when people find out where I'm shopping because you got these crazy crowds. But obviously when you have the likes of Mr. LeBron James, J.R. Smith, and the rest of the crew, the store's got a little crazy, as you can imagine. So I believe we were talking about your career, and I know you were talking to us about school and how you went that route and kind of switch routes in terms of from going the doctor route.
Good grandma. All right, so I know where I was. I was talking.
Which is crazy that we literally stopped. We literally stopped
right there.
This podcast went and had brunch for 3 hours and came back and recorded it now. So,
all right. I gotta figure out how to jump back into it. But
you had changed courses from going doctor route to.
I disappointed my mom. That's where I left it off, I think. And she was like, "Why aren't you going to be a doctor?" So I took the time off. And I literally had a lady come to me and say, "Hey, I'll pay you. You know, you're in music because you're DJing. So I'll pay you to tell me what's happening at these clubs and parties. I'll pay you to go to Miami. I'll pay you to go to Cancun. Pay you to..." Yeah, so I'm like, "Is this legal?
Are they hiring? I'll take that right now."
Like, "Is this legal?" She's like, "Yeah." So I took the job. And I would go into these boardrooms with companies like Coke and Kyocera, Puma, Shefflin, Somerset. And I would tell them what kids were drinking, what they were mixing, what they were wearing, what music was playing. And what I didn't realize is that I was talking to marketers and telling marketers what was happening from a consumer perspective. I always tell everyone, marketing found me. I didn't really know what marketing was. I didn't know what a CMO was at that point in my life. Like, I thought the most senior guy at Nike was the guy with the clipboard at the manufacturer who told you what shift he was coming in. So this is where I started to meet a lot of marketers and brand managers and brand directors. I did that for about 5 years, and obviously I think I got pretty okay at it. And went to a mentor, said, "I want to go client side like every consultant does." And he told me, "You got to get an MBA. At this point, we did have the internet, so I went home, looked on the internet, took a course, and then I ended up in business school. I applied to NYU and Emory in Atlanta. Chose Emory, and...
Now, at this point, where are you living at this point?
I'm living in Atlanta.
Okay.
I did an internship at Kraft Foods in the summer, so I was in New York and New Jersey, but I was based in Atlanta. And, went to Emory in Atlanta, chose Emory because of a focus on, they had a focus on leadership and leadership communication, like crisis communication or kind of communication courses, in addition to brand management. So finished there, I had my internship at Kraft went, I thought it went great. I think my director would say it went horribly bad. I did a presentation at the end of the summer with all my work, and the presentation was probably close to something I would present today. And the director says to me, he says, "You know, I don't think this is for you. Consumer packaged goods aren't for you. You probably would do better if you went to like a footwear company or like a music company." So that crushed me. All right. And I was like, "Fuck you, I'm gonna do it." So I spent my whole second year trying to get back into a consumer packaged goods company. And when I graduated, I went to Campbell's Soup.
Like the soup? Yeah,
Campbell's Soup.
Wow. Okay.
I worked on Pace Salsa.
I don't even know what that is, I'm going to be honest with you. No idea what that is.
Your bougie ass wouldn't know what it is. You wouldn't know what Pace Salsa is.
No idea what that is.
There's a whole aisle in the supermarket dedicated to salsa. Like, there's a lot of salsa.
Like, for chips and stuff?
For chips. Chips and dips. And I worked on Pace Salsa for a year. And, you know, I actually realized what the guy was talking about. Like, it really wasn't for me. I think I lived half my life in Camden, New Jersey, and the other half in Bentonville, Arkansas.
Yeah, no. But I know where one of those is, and I have no interest in knowing where the other one is that I don't know it is. So
leave those alone. That said, I mean, I learned a lot. I learned a lot about marketing from those companies. I learned a lot about positioning. I learned a lot about when you take a product and start to storytell around it and how you position it against other products, how you position it against itself. I learned a lot from those companies.
But how soon, while you're in that role, are you thinking, okay, this may not be for me, I'm looking elsewhere? How soon is that happening?
I don't think I was looking because I was so hell-bent on proving that guy wrong.
Okay.
you know, I think if I opened my eyes up when I got there day one, I probably would have figured it out, but I was so hell-bent on proving them wrong and being successful. So I was. Things worked out well. And Nike started to call. And Nike called, and I talked to Nike for about a year. And then Nike eventually offered me a program. It's called a marketing development program, which is a rotational program built to give you like 4 years of experience in two. And that sounded amazing. Like, go to Nike, you get to learn a lot really fast. It was sponsored by their CMO. That was a big opportunity for me. So after a year, I left and I went to Nike.
And when you say you left, you went to Nike, you left Atlanta and went to
Beaverton. I was actually in, I lived in Philly, but I worked in Camden, New Jersey, which was...
It's like worst to worst.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
It was bad. Philly to Camden.
Well, Philly wasn't bad. I was downtown Philly. I was in on Pine and 11th. I was in a good spot near Rittenhouse Square. But, yeah, going to work every day was depressing.
I'm
like
sure.
You cross the bridge and you go into, like, Camden wasn't a great place to go.
So you're going to Nike now. Are you thinking you made it? Like we made it.
Oh, I'm done.
One of the swoops.
I'm done. I'm happy. I'm like, I'm going to start a career here. I'm going to retire here. I'm going to get the swoosh. I'm going to get the Nike tattoo on the ankle. Like, I mean, I'm still hardcore Nike. That's never changed. But at that point in my life, I didn't think about going anywhere else. I felt really good about the brand. I felt great about what I could do there. And I felt like, you know, it was a really good fit for, like, my talent, what I could do, and it felt like a brand that I felt good at, so.
So what was the rotational program like? Like, it was a year?
It was 2 years.
Two years.
Okay. I spent time in global brand management. I spent time in U.S. brand management. Spent time in retail, U.S. retail, and I spent time on global PR. So, like, global PR was the Air Force One 25th anniversary.
I remember that, yeah.
At U.S. retail, I launched Nike Plus at U.S. retail, which was our first ever connected launch. Like, most of the stores didn't even have internet service.
Mm. And did you gravitate to any of those at the beginning? Like, you did the rotational and you worked on retail and PR and brand. Did you gravitate to one? Like,
yeah,
you knew what you wanted to do?
I like the global work because I've been curious since I've been a kid. And I also like storytelling in different cultures. So the global rotations and roles felt best to me because I could do it and I could learn. I always like when I can work and I can learn at the same time. So global always kept me learning, always kept me a little bit uncomfortable and in a space where I was always absorbing new information. So all the global stuff really appealed to me. And then I think the only other thing that appealed to me was this bridge between technology and products. And when you think about what Nike Plus was to the brand, it was that bridge between sneakers and technology. So those two things have always been important to me, and that was an exciting part of that chapter at Nike.
And then, so how's it work? You know, your rotational program is over. Do they offer you a gig? Is a gig guaranteed? Do you get to pick where you're working? Like, how's that work?
Those are great questions. I'm not sure the program had it figured out, but they built the program to invest in talent. So, you know, when the program was over, I secured a job. I was offered a job in our brand connections group, which is basically a hybrid of, at this point, it was advertising, content, and a few other support functions. But it was all about making content 24/7.
And what are some of the things you worked on while in that role, or as you progressed?
I did a lot of Nike Plus, so I got to work on a partnership with Apple. This is actually a chapter where I got to meet Jimmy Iovine, because we were licensing music for Apple, for the Apple platform, and we had a really interesting model. We didn't really have a model to do it, and I came up with this idea, and I said, look, if we can get a really big record label to kind of pre-clear music for us, it'll really help the platform. And everyone said I was crazy, like, it'll never happen. The record labels think we have a bunch of money, they'll never go for it. I said, if we can find a really progressive music guy to say yes, and we set a precedent, we can keep this thing going. And that guy was Jimmy Iovine.
What was your first impression of Jimmy?
Like, fear.
Like, sounds about right.
You know, you hear all these rumors about the music industry, and when you think about Interscope, in the 90s and early 2000s, I mean, they weren't fire.
So for some of, like, our younger listeners, like to you and I, like, Interscope in the 90s, like, that's what it was, right? Like, yeah. Who were some of the acts Jimmy worked with and Interscope kind of?
Everything from Def Row to Pac to Snoop to Eminem to Lady Gaga to Dre to 50 Cent. I mean, you, if it was hot in the late 90s, early 2000s, it was coming.
Out of Interscope.
Probably. Out of Interscope. Mm. So I go in for this meeting, and I've got, you know, I walk into this big music industry boardroom, and it was, I never forget, it was super intimidating. Cause it was,
is this the big boardroom at Interscope?
Yeah.
Which,
yeah,
by the
yeah.
way, is the size of half a football field. Yeah. Like,
you've been in that room. Yes. You've been in that, it's like a cauldron.
Yes, and I've been in a corner, like, hoping no one calls my name. Yeah. Yes. I've been in there with you.
Yeah. Okay, so that same room where you hope no one call your name, it was my presentation. Room's buzzing. And eventually, Jimmy walks in, room gets really quiet. He just sits down and he says, go. All right? No hello, no how are you doing, no set the agenda, no like, we're here to see this, everybody. This is Omar, which is go. I start presenting, and literally two slides in, he's like, what the fuck are you talking about? You want to make money from our music? Are you fucking crazy?
Oh, my God.
So there's nothing in business school that equipped me for that.
Right. Like, and who's in the room with you from your side? Like, from the
Nike
side?
I've got Mark Tomashow, one of my favorite people.
Yes, good guy.
Mark Tomashow, please make sure you listen to this. I had the heads of entertainment marketing, and I had one of my favorite people, Nike, was from legal. Everybody out there, when you make friends at your companies you work for, make a friend at legal. If you make a friend in legal and a friend in finance, life gets really easy. Yeah. But I had those four people in my room. I think there were 45 Interscope people and my four people.
So when Jimmy barks this question at you, are you like, hard stop, someone jump in and help, who can I tag in? Or are you like, what are you thinking in that moment?
So, well, let me tell you what I was feeling. First, you know how when something like that happens, you feel the sweat accumulate on your face? And you just feel big globs of sweat accumulating on your head. That you get a big knot in your throat, and then I'm not sure. I mean, I checked my underwear after and it was okay, but
it was good.
Yeah, I didn't know what was going on. But he says that, and your first instinct is like, wow, it's like shots fired, like this is real. It's not a game. And I always tell people something like my Brooklyn came out of me, because I just turned around and I said, yo, I said, you interested in making more money than you make today? And he's like, what? I said, are you interested in making more money than you make today? And he was like, yeah. I was like, can I go? And he's like, yeah. And he let me, he didn't even let me finish. I think I had 20 something slides by the time I got to 14. He goes, you signed a deal, you book studio time, we're doing this deal. Walks out the room.
It's so not only Jimmy, you know, but it's so music industry, right? Like, music industry doesn't have time, man. Like, get to your point. Don't give me fluff. Don't play a video for me. What are you selling? How are you selling it? How much is it going to cost me? You know, am I buying or not? Like, there's no wasted time.
Oh, and what I know now is he was testing me to see if I believed in myself, if I believed in the idea. You find that with executives like that, they're buying a person and their passion for the idea, because they know that person has to go out and do it. So he was testing me to see if I really had the balls to pull it off. He tested me to make sure I wasn't just presenting some document in pretty slides. He wanted to make sure I really believed and understood the idea. And I did. So I think that's what he bought. And, you know, glad to say, a year later, I gave him a check for $3 million. We featured a couple of his songs and a couple of ads. So it all worked out really, really, really well.
So fast forwarding, as fate would have it.
Well, let me get back to Nike, because you got the spinach of Nike.
Yes,
so,
yes, go ahead.
So continued at Nike, working on this project, and then moving into advertising. And that's where I worked on Nike basketball and running. So a lot of footwear launches, and then got to work on Kobe and LeBron, which basically was Nike basketball
right.
at that point in time in my career. So everything from the puppets to a lot of LeBron work. LeBron work when he left Cleveland. There was a lot of LeBron work I got to work on.
Yeah, when you say basically it was Nike basketball, and basically when you look back at it, like, that was Nike. Like, LeBron and Kobe in their primes, like, it literally was like halo effect. Like, that was the Nike brand. Like,
yeah.
And you were working on that type of work. What's your proudest? What's your favorite campaign you worked on?
Nike?
I know they're all your babies. Yeah, but Nike.
The puppets.
Puppets?
Yeah, I mean, who makes puppets?
Right.
Like, you know, billion-dollar brand. says we're going to take our two most amazing athletes on the planet who do amazing things on the court and make them into puppets. So that was fun. And it was fun because it not only let me see what a fully integrated campaign looked like, it was really interesting and disruptive and reactive. We made content for TV. We made content for basketball tournaments. When Rice played Christ the King.
We started working together.
Working together. But, you know, we were able to be, it showed me a big campaign that could actually activate a small event. So it really, I think, a lot of that work there really formed how I think, even how I think it beats, where we may do things that are big and for TV, but we also try and create things that are very nimble, and we try and create things that users can also own. So I've been to a lot of campaigns at Nike, but that was one of my favorite ones because it felt different, it felt disruptive, it felt creative. I was a part of the writing and production. I mean, just the set, can you imagine, 50 puppeteers same time working? You've got a director. So again, you think of the complexity of that. It's not just action and you directing action, you're directing puppets.
That's
and
crazy. Then, I didn't even think about it like that.
Right.
That's crazy.
And it's all puppeteers and puppets. And so that was some of my favorite work when I was there.
So, here's a kid from Brooklyn that has always been a fan of Nike, always been a fan of sport, always been a fan of creating. And now you're at Nike, arguably, the greatest sports brand in the world, if not one of the best brands in the world. You're working on, global shit. You're working on stuff that the world sees. You're working with the biggest athletes in the world, the biggest moments, you're creating stuff. When does it enter your mind that you may want to make a move?
Oh,
like, most people are like, this is my dream job.
I was done. I was done. I think the moment it entered my mind, here's what I'd say. I mean, I kept a relationship with Jimmy through the music stuff that we were doing.
If you made me $3 million, we'd keep a relationship too.
Exactly. So I started seeing these headphones pop up on his desk, and I never paid him any attention. I mean, he asked me what I thought about them, and I said what everyone in the world said. They're really expensive. I don't know how we're going to compete with Bose. I don't think you can compete with Bose. You should do some consumer research, blah, 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 blah. Everything a traditional marketer says, I literally said to him. And he's like, okay, great, right?
Thanks.
Yeah, thanks. So I saw that thing coming, and LeBron actually gave me my first pair of Beats. So my first pair of Beats that I got was the ones from More Than a Game. So this is when More Than a Game is happening, and they made a special limited edition. He gave me a pair. Well, he gave the whole team a pair, and I listened to them, and I really liked them. And at the end of the day, I still can't say I ever thought about leaving Nike. And I remember it all happened in one day because my name started to float around. And I was literally at a meeting in L.A. in Orange County, meeting you-know-who over in Newport.
Mm-hmm.
Orange County. And I'm driving back up the 405. That's 405. 405 North. I always got a convertible when I was in L.A. just to absorb as much sun as possible. Because Portland...
So Portland will do to you, man.
Yeah. Portland had an amazing lack of sun. And I think my vitamin D levels were low. Like, it was just bad when I was there. But I'm driving up, and I got a phone call while I'm driving on the 405. They thought I was in Portland. And it was Beats calling, and they said, we should talk. I just happened to be on the 405. I just happened to be close to the office. So I later that day, when I clocked out of my Nike job, I literally called back, and we talked. I went to meet Jimmy, and that's when we had our first conversation about it.
And you leave that meeting thinking this is a possibility, or I don't know, or shit just may really happen.
The thing that was interesting in that meeting is I walked into the meeting thinking, like, hell no, there's no way this works out. I'm just not interested. I'm not interested in working with the music industry. And not that I love music, but I just heard so many things about the industry. And I was like, I don't want to necessarily work in that space. It didn't feel like a meritocracy. It didn't feel like a space that I wanted to be in. And something really interesting happened at lunch. I'm sitting there talking to Jimmy, and he's talking about the job, and I heard it all. I never forget the moment his daughter comes in, because his daughter comes in and sits next to him, and he was talking about this really big deal, and he just stops talking about business and just focuses on his daughter. And I mean, not like, what's wrong, but like, hey, how's your day? How was your breakfast? Like, the most simple things.
Like, real family shit.
Well, that's what I realized. I was like, you know, he's a family guy. Mm. And then in my head, I'm like, oh, well, if you're part of the family, then you get into a very different place. So once I realized he was a family guy, I'm like, okay, this could work out for me. I left, and I didn't think about it too much, but they pursued, and we talked. And eventually, it was a really tough decision. And I talked to every mentor I had. They all told me I shouldn't do it. And
because that's also, you know, our listeners now may be listening and thinking about it like, oh, you left to go to Beats, and Beats, you know.
This is, yeah, Beats yeah, was.
Apple and, yeah. You know, and this and that and all this. Like, tell us what Beats was back then. Like, refresh our listeners' minds on, like, what the Beats brand was when you're thinking about this decision.
Oh, I mean, Beats at that point were, and if you think about it from just what the category was, they were overpriced, cool-looking headphones a few celebrities were wearing. There was nothing in the category like it. There was nothing in the category to substantiate that you could make that much money and sell a huge volume of these things. And yeah, Beats was a startup. So as much of a startup as Beats could have been, it was. I mean, we were in a corner of Interscope Records. It was six of us. So
Beats six of you working on the Beats brand.
That's it. Holy yeah. shit. I mean, the record label, the good news with Jimmy is Jimmy had everybody kind of participating.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, it was like a team of like, you know, five people that initially started working on the brand. So it wasn't as sexy as it is today. It wasn't, I didn't feel a sense of stability. I didn't feel a sense of, you know, this is going to work out and be amazing. No one had a clue it would have been a $1 billion company. I mean, we were hoping it would be a $200-300 million company, which would made everybody really happy. We had no clue it could be as big as it was. So when I'm leaving Nike, and I never forget the faces, because I talked to a few people, all my mentors kind of said, look, it's your decision, but I wouldn't leave where you are. You're in a great place. You're in a great group. You're working on advertising. People see the work you work on TV. Like, how cool is that? And I can't say what it was, but what I said, look, I feel like I'm really good at what I do, and I felt like if I stayed at Nike, it would have taken me 10 years to really see my full potential, mm-hmm. because I think I got pretty good at being a marketer, but there's just a natural sort of trajectory that you have as a brand manager and then a senior brand manager, and I was at the bottom end of that totem pole, and I felt like I could do big work, and this was my shot for me to kind of bet on myself and say, you know, if you think you're really good, if you think you really could fucking do it, go do it.
Now, are your friends and family looking at you like you're out of your fucking mind?
Yeah. Everybody. My friends, my family. You know, the only person who there was two. There was Lisa, my wife, and there was my mom. And they weren't. They just ride or die. Mm-hmm. So
they didn't necessarily think it was a great move.
Yeah, they didn't think it was a great move, but they're like, you're going, yep. riding with yep. you. And I mean, they bet on me also. So, you know, I took that pressure into the role. And, you know, when I got there, it was scary, man, because you go there and you think of a startup and you're like, oh, they're going to have HR and they're going to have everything from benefits and all the things that you have at your job, a legal team, a procurement team. You think of all those things that you're used to having. We had none of that. It was us.
It's actually funny. You know, anyone that's listened to my show before knows, you know, not only my affinity and love for the Beats brand, but knows I worked there as well. What they may or may not know is that you actually hired me, that I went and worked for you. Mm-hmm. But one of the stories I love to tell is, you know, whenever you relocate, most companies, at least big companies, will put you in temporary housing till you find your you know, permanent home or whatnot. And Beats put me in a temporary housing, let's just say I didn't feel was like up to the standard it needed to be. But kudos to the HR team. You know, I brought it to their attention and they fixed it right away. And next day I was in a suitable place. So there's a young lady, Kai. Remember Kai? Mm-hmm. Okay. Kai comes over and this young lady, Omar, hires, and she starts working the Beats company probably maybe 3 months after I started. And you know, she was late, and she's like, sorry, I'm late. You know, I actually was moving into my temp housing. I'm like, where'd you move into? And she's like, oh, I moved into this nice place. And they moved her into the place that Beats fixed my situation and moved me into.
Right.
So I told her, I said, hey, you should thank me because I took bullets for you. You didn't have to live in the place I lived in. And then someone that I know, you know, you're a huge fan of that's on your team, Erica, comes and goes, wait a minute, you had temp housing when you came in, right?
We didn't have that.
So it's literally that. It's literally like the progression of something as simple as corporate housing. You know, one employee that started, you know, 6 months ago, they didn't have it at all. I had it and it wasn't great. And then the person after me had it and it was perfect. So just seeing the brand was growing and evolving like 360 from the work we're doing, from the staffing, from the processes. So that was interesting. So what was your first, do you remember your first meeting with Dre, with Dr. Dre?
Oh, yeah.
Once you're at Beats.
Yeah, I remember my first meeting. You know, it's interesting because you kind of tapped on this earlier where you said that there's like no time for bullshit. Like, you know, you think I go and sit in front of Dre and I'm like, well, here's, you know, my objectives and here's my strategy and here's how the tactics roll out. So very sort of, you know, clear strategic plan.
Yeah, you're a marketer, right?
And I'm using big words like amplify and execute and all those words you hear marketers say every day, especially at the big sexy companies. And you could just see him, like, he looks at me like, and he twists his head to the side like I have four fucking heads. And what I realized is that I was speaking a different language to him. And Jimmy just, like, stops me. He's like, what are the ideas? What's your idea? And I'm like, what's my idea? And I literally started talking about my idea. And then the room lit up. And then he was like, oh, I like that idea. We're good. What if we did this? What if we did it this way? What if we get this person to do it? Like, we started talking in a language of ideas. And to this day, I mean, that's kind of what wins at Beats still, is ideas. And it was interesting for me because it didn't mean that I couldn't be strategic. It just meant put that shit in your book bag, be strategic. But when it comes down to what matters, there's what are you going to execute? How's it going to impact the market? And how much are we going to sell? And, you know, it's funny now, I watch so many marketers talk themselves in circles and talk about what they're going to do and strategically. And then when you get to the idea section, it's the weakest section.
Yeah.
It really is the weakest thing. And then when you get to the execution, which is even weaker than the weak idea, you see why some marketers don't have the same kind of impact we had. So it's really interesting coming from, again, you think about Campbell's, Kraft, these big brands where I learned traditional brand management. I learned storytelling at Nike and flawless execution at Nike. Beats is really where I got an opportunity to put all of that together and focus on execution to actually drive a business.
And it's funny, you know, I've been in meetings and you just cringe when someone has, you know, a very pretty PowerPoint deck presentation and they have all these big words and mission, vision, position, and someone, whoever they're pitching to, asks a very simple question, like, what do you mean by that? And they freeze up.
No clue.
It sounds amazing, though. You know, we're going to do this, that, and the third. And what do you mean by that? And they're like, fucked.
Yeah.
You know, like, so, you know, you've always been a big, you know, proponent of, let's get to the ideas. Let's have amazing ideas, and then let's work them and figure out how we execute them and make them even bigger. Don't give me the fluff. Don't give me, you know, the 9 setup slides, the 2 idea slides, and then the 1 execution slide. Like, it's interesting to see that. And I think for me, you know, again, during my short time at Beats, I remember being in a handful of meetings, you know, all with you, but being in rooms with Jimmy, Iveen, and being in rooms with Dre, and always just being in awe of A, right? They're living, like, literally the definition of living legends, right?
Mm-hmm.
And B, just how smart those dudes were, where they would always say the least amount in the meeting, but the most impactful, and always spot on.
Yep.
Right? It's like, I think Jimmy, I tell people, Jimmy has this amazing ability of taking something that is very complex or seems complex and simplifying it, like, well, seems to me that if we do A, we get B. And you have all these smart people in the room look at you like, holy shit, he's right. If we do that, like, you know. And then my Dre story is the same thing. Being in a room with him and him just being quiet, you kind of aren't even sure if he's really paying attention, right? Like, first of all, you don't even expect Dr. Dre to be in a meeting, right? It's Dr.
Right,
Dre.
Right.
And he's in a meeting and he says, like, you know, just all the important shit. Like, yo, it needs to be authentic. If it ain't real, we can't do it. I don't care how cool it is. And you're like, damn, like.
Oh, he's just like, that shit's corny.
Yes.
Like, and he'll say that.
Yep.
And it's
yep.
like, if you ain't got a backup, let me say a backup idea, if you can't spar back and forth idea-wise, he's off.
Yep. At least have a very strong point of view.
Yep.
Have a point of view. Even if it's wrong, have a point of view. I don't know if you remember my first day at Beats. I turned the corner to the marketing section, your section, and people are literally running around with their hair on fire, like Mach 2. And I'm like, what the hell is going on? And they're looking at these boards up on like the wall outside Omar's office, and people are literally running back and forth. And I'm like, what in the world? And someone tells me, I don't think it was you, it might have been even been your assistant at the time, Brittany. She tells me, Jimmy's not happy with the people we have on the website. Remember that? And I was like, Jimmy looks at the website? Like, this is the file? Like, looks at the website?
Right.
And you told me, you're like, yo, Jimmy doesn't even want people to think, you know, that the brand's a reflection of him. Like, the brand is him. Like, everything has to be authentic. No actors, no casting, no nothing. It has to be real people. You want people with scars on their faces. You want fat people. You want skinny people. You want black people, white, purple hair. You know, like, did you sense that as you were going through it? Like, how authentic everything had to be there at that brand?
Yeah, I mean, and he's in every detail, which was amazing. I mean, his instincts, to your point, are uncanny, but he's in every detail. And if he's not in it, someone who knows him is in it. So he's always, I always tell people, Jimmy's always 1 degree away from knowing everything that you're doing. Be it a meeting you're having, if you're bullshitting somebody somewhere, like, he will hear about it. And he proved the truth every day. So, you know, it was amazing to me to see someone able to be, to your point, to be that strategic and able to distill down that many details into here's what you go and do, but also be able to connect with any and every detail around the brand, from the packaging to how many boxes we had on shelf, to our weekly runway rate, to our website, the images on our website, our ads, whether the length of our ad, I mean, every detail. He wanted to know for me, where are the ads running? I want to know what time. I mean, literally down to what time the ads were running.
That's
and
crazy.
Sure enough, I get a text from him saying, oh, I just saw the ad. So, I mean, I think that always amazed me, just the capacity for information. And that really forced me to expand my capacity for information, where I was able to deal with super, super detail-oriented details, but also able to look at big strategy. Now, just a clarifying point, because I think, you know, I've done this before where I'll say things on stage and people are like, oh, Omar's saying we don't do strategy. I'm not saying not presenting strategy absolves you from strategy.
Right.
I'm saying that if you're strategic and your leadership has done a good enough job, your strategy is set. And
very big difference.
Your strategy is set.
Yep.
And whatever strategy, so your bigger macro strategy is set, whatever you're doing should strategically line up. So do you have to repeat your strategy, my strategy to me? Probably not. And it should line up with the idea. So I'm not saying that you can't have strategy. I'm just saying when it comes time to present, if you're really good at what you're doing, it's less about repeating and reciting strategy and getting into what the idea is. So you have to still have it. It's just not something that we spend a lot of time presenting to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And again, this was as a startup also, so we couldn't really get into the idea because we were so small. And there wasn't a ton of space for things to go too far off of strategy because everything kind of stayed really tight.
Right, and everyone was so involved in it, right? From Jimmy to Andre, you, like, you guys had your hands in literally, like, if we're doing a custom headphone, that needs to be seen, you know? So I think, like, your fingerprints were all over the brand from A to Z, right? A flyer, right? We've always talked about that. Like, anything, which at any other brand, I don't think that could happen or would happen.
Yeah. And I've always said, like, you know, to your point about the brand being, it was always their brand, and I've always been a steward. Like, my job has always been, how do I steward this brand? And, you know, my goal each day was like, this thing is great. Like, don't fuck it up.
Yeah.
And do what you can to preserve it, grow it, and amplify it. But I've always said that, you know, my job was to operationalize what they created. Like, the identity and idea of Beats was created by Jimmy and Dre, and they started to execute against that. I just had to figure out how to operationalize that. It wasn't about, you know, do I come with, you know, I had to bring ideas in how we do that. But the idea of what the brand was and what the brand stood for was very clear. Just like Nike has sport, Beats has always had sound, and Beats has always had that authenticity to the artist. So, you know, as you and I both learned at Nike, you know, the fact that everybody's so passionate about sports actually makes the job a little bit easier in some circumstances and harder in some circumstances, but you're always clear. because that always becomes a bar that you're making sure that you stay authentic to. There was always a very clear bar when it came to Jimmy and Dre from an aesthetic perspective. I mean, you know, you look at, we've made some cool ads, but you think of between Jimmy, Dre, or President Loop, they've probably made 700 to 1,000 music videos.
Yeah.
Right? So again, to put it in perspective, like, you know, the 12 ads that we've done that have been great, I mean, they did that in, you know, a year. And that company, Interscope, was amazing for a lot of years. And obviously, I mean, you look at, again, you think aesthetic and Dre, Straight Outta Compton, you think about the music videos, you think about something like California Love and what they did there. They've been making great content for a long time. So for me, it was like, how do I not fuck up what they've created?
Right.
It was less about how do I go and create something new. It was more like, these guys have something aesthetically. These guys have something creatively. How do we make sure that this thing stays alive and we're expressing different voices and different languages, different consumers? But what it was always very clear. It was always set.
You know, one of the things, you know, people always ask me, like, you know, what was most impressive to you, you know, at Beats or even now with the Beats brand? And, you know, people will say, like, you know, the headphones themselves or, you know, the marketing or whatever the case may be. And you mentioned this word earlier, sport, mm-hmm. right? I think when you think of Beats or any other, you know, audio or headphone company, whatever people may call it, you think of music and you think of, like, sound quality, right? And most brands stop there. How does sports thing happen? Like, I go back to, like, the ESPN cover with LeBron and Dre on the cover saying, you know, how Beats took over the locker room, right? Like, that's crazy. Like, that's normally, like, a Gatorade or a Nike or something. Like, when did the pivot or the thinking of kind of dominating sport come about? Was that a comment? Like, do you remember that? Like,
yeah, I remember it clearly. For me, to be very honest with you, it was survival. You know, I started, when I first got to the brand, you think, we're a headphone company, we'll do music. Jimmy and Dre were doing a lot of music, and I tried to follow in their footsteps. But what happened is, I'd do something in music, and I'd be like, Jimmy, I come into his office all excited, like, Jimmy, look what I did. And he's like, oh, yeah, I signed that guy 2 years ago, right? Or I do something different. He's like, oh, yeah, we gave them a record label deal. That's what had happened. So I just felt like, damn, like, I can't win here. And it kind of forced me into some of my old instincts. And the one thing, you know, I've always known is there's a really strong connection between music and sports. And athletes use music. And again, I learned a lot of this when I was at Nike. I learned a lot of this just from behavior. And then by working with the athletes as closely as we did, we knew before games LeBron was in the music. We knew, like, our key guys, music was a big part of what they did before sports. So I even did more research. If you look back to, like, John McEnroe and a lot of big athletes, music was a really important part of sport. So I said, okay, you guys got the music lane. I can't really win there. So I'll look through something in sports. And that was where we started our sports strategy. Obviously, LeBron was a part of the brand before I got there. Mm-hmm. But we started partnering, doing more stuff with LeBron. And then that really started to fan out. After we started working with LeBron, we started working in football. When I mean football, most people call it soccer in North America. We started working with a couple of football athletes. And what I tried to do was really use sports to globalize the brand. Because I knew if we could tackle sports like football and we could tackle sports like tennis, we could really push the brand globally. So sports became, you know, a big strength for us. And like I said, a big part of it was survival. We knew it was authentic. And at the end of the day, I think a lot of our big, big, big moments, you think about the Olympics, you think about World Cup, those have been some of the more globally explosive events that the Beats brand has sort of participated in. So it was a combination of, as I said, me just trying to figure out what I could bring to Beats.
Right, personally.
You think about what these legends brought to Beats. I was trying to figure out what I could bring to Beats and the authenticity of that story. And we set a very simple goal in the beginning. We said we want to be the official pregame headphone of all sports. You remember that slide. Mm-hmm. You probably saw that in your first day, mm-hmm. which was, if we become the pregame headphone, then we win. And we sought to go out and dominate every pregame moment across every sport.
Does it still bug you out when you're walking down the street and see someone wearing headphones?
Oh, yeah. I still count. I still count every time I'm on a plane. I count how many people have on our competitors, how many people have on ours. When I'm looking at a team get off a bus, I still count. When I'm looking on Instagram, I see teams. I'm like, how many people have on Beats? How many people have on other? I mean, every chance I can get. When I go to a store or if I'm walking in the airport past In Motion, I stop to see what people are shopping, if it's Beats or if it's another brand. I'm super competitive. So for me, my battleground, you know, like LeBron has the finals and mm-hmm. Serena has the big opens. You know, my battleground is Best Buy and Fnac and In Motion. That's where I get to go and compete and fight against my enemies.
So you spoke about, you know, counting people wearing your headphones. And why do you think athletes choose to wear Beats? I mean, look, if you're an athlete and you're a pro, you're LeBron, you're Serena, you're a Cam Newton, you have enough money to wear whatever you want to wear. You don't got to wear what anyone tells you or do any of these fake deals or anything like that. Like, what is it about Beats that the best athletes in the world, you know, want to wear them and want to kind of be, you know, associated with the brand?
That's a great question. And you think about what Beats stands for, which is about connecting you to that emotion that the artist wants you to experience in the studio. And if you think about what the athlete's doing with the headphones, I've been told they do three things with it. One, they use it to block out noise, which can be fans booing, fans saying, you've heard the things that fans can say when you go into a and you go into an away game.
Absolutely.
Yeah, we've heard it all. But we've heard athletes say they use it to block out what's going on the outside.
We just heard some of it walking around Toronto.
Yes,
actually.
We did. Yes, we did. We've heard athletes use it for just building rhythm and repetition. And when you think about what repetition means in sports, I mean, that's a difference. When you look at, you know, some of the great players out there, just because they have great repetition in what they do, they know how to execute a shot from different places. The last thing is athletes will say they use music to transform and to become whatever they're going to become on the field, the court, the pitch that day. If you get back to the essence of what the brand stands for and how Dre tuned our headphones, he tuned our headphones for emotion. So if you're an athlete trying to get that emotional edge over your competition, our headphones far exceeds any other product out there. Most headphones, as you guys know, are probably tuned by engineers and people who don't make the best music on the planet, where our headphones are tuned by the guys who created one of the most successful record labels in the world and some of the most successful music in the world. So we sound very different, and athletes tend to gravitate to that more emotional sound. That's a big part of why they choose us. Another thing, our headphones just look better. Right. Like, aesthetically, we just look better. It doesn't hurt that, you know, if a team is, their colors are, you know, royal blue, white, and orange, that, you know, some royal blue, white, and orange headphones show up in a locker room or get given to a player. That doesn't hurt either.
So,
and that's the footwear game, which
absolutely,
it's the footwear
right.
game.
It's
so
like,
right, that's the footwear game.
Absolutely.
So much as it, you know, it seems like this cool idea, it's the footwear game, right? It's that one-on-one that you make that sells 40,000 units out of the inline.
So I know something that's very near and dear to your heart, and it's kind of the common thread that goes throughout your career is storytelling, mm-hmm. right? And I think the way you've been able to tell stories around some of the things you just discussed, athletes wearing headphones or just authenticity and, you know, music mm-hmm. and, you know, talk to me a little bit about your philosophy, your thinking around, like, the Beats campaigns. Like, it looks very different than anything else on TV. The spots are way different, in a different world than, you know, I'm using air quotes, you know, competitors. Like, what's your point of view? What's your thinking around just the campaign work the brand has done that you've led? And I know it's a loaded question, but
it's a loaded question, so I'll kind of give you a bit of a loaded answer. The you know, being the oldest child, being in a household with my mom alone, you know, I've seen my family go through addictions. I've had there was a lot of death when I was younger, and it wasn't like natural causes death when I was younger. My father going away. You know, I had all these things in my head that I want, in my heart that I wanted to express, and I didn't really have anybody to express it to. And mom, if you hear this, don't get upset. Every kid goes through this, but I've always appreciated things that tell stories. And it could be a package. It could be a pamphlet. It could be an ad on TV. It could be the way somebody greets you in a store. So from very young, I've always wanted to storytell. I was never encouraged to sort of write or express myself. So, you know, marketing became my tool of expression. Now, when I was young, I called it hustle. It was hustle. That's what we all called it. It was hustle. And you know, I could hustle you some ice in December if I had to. But that art of storytelling is a very live and it's very alive and especially Black culture. And where I'm from, like, you think about everything from hip hop to what was happening when I was coming up, from the brands like the Rockaways, and you started to really see commerce come from the hustle. And I've always appreciated the ability of those people to tell stories. And being a kid who didn't have a voice, who always had these things, you know, I had this really creative imagination that I used to kind of escape different moments in my life, and never really having a way to talk about that, storytelling became the way I do it, or did it. So you fast forward now where, you know, I look at storytelling as a craft, and I look at everything from how something opens, how it closes, to every element of it, to me, is part of the storytelling. And I look at storytelling in a very simple way. It's, how do you use emotion to connect with people? Because if I tell you a story and you don't have any emotional connection to it, you probably won't remember it. And I also look to make sure the stories are super authentic. So, I mean, I'm telling the truth. And I always push myself and our team. I always say, you have to get to real deep insights. And the very simple rule is, if it's in Wikipedia, it's not an insight, right? Because all my competition has it. So if it's in Wikipedia, all the other guys can read it. So I'm always pushing to get deeper insights. When you look at our athletes that we talk to and the trust we build with them, it's all about getting insights out and things that they don't say. And what I love to do when it comes to, like, our content is, I love to say the things that everybody's thinking, but nobody says. Like, people are afraid to say it. So when you think about those goals and objectives for your creative output, the creative actually becomes a little bit easier, because you're like, if it's not authentic, we're not doing it. If it's some bullshit that came out of Wikipedia as an insight, we're not doing it. If we're not using every part of the creative, be it, you know, the media slot we buy, to how long it is, to whether we put it online or we put it on social media, if we're not using all those things, we don't do it either. So storytelling is something that, you know, I'm learning more and more every day. I can't say I'm amazing at it, but I think it's this amazing thing that allows me to do something that I wasn't able to do as a kid. And it's funny how, you know, even as an adult, like, you're still kind of playing out the things that happened in your childhood. And a big part of my focus on storytelling is, you know, people talk a lot about our World Cup ad that we made with Neymar Jr. When we made it, you know, we made a lot of really big creative decisions, and what you see on that script and what you see on that screen are dramatically different. What I've come to realize 3 years after, as a big part of what I was making, is I made the spot be something I wanted my father to say to me. And as much as it, you know, worked for me, it worked for some other people. But again, how great is that you work at this big brand and you're still, again, playing out these emotional things and stories from, like, your childhood? And that's a big part of what storytelling is to me.
So, you know, and it's funny because we didn't discuss any of what we were going to discuss. I'm literally asking you questions cold turkey purposely. Okay. But that's a great transition to, I'm gonna tell you a phrase right now. And I want you to tell me what it means to you, and what it meant to you when you first heard it, and what it meant to you in terms of just your past and how you've gotten to where you're at right now. And the saying is, "Beats out Nike's Nike." Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Ad Age, was it?
Yeah, an ad trade. Right. Ad Age or Fast Company or, yeah.
So it was around the Olympics, it was around World Cup.
Yeah.
Right? And you had just put out, you know, the amazing World Cup spot that you just referenced with Neymar and his dad and a bunch of other global footballers. And they came out and they said, "Beats out Nike's Nike." Which, to any brand would be like the holy grail, holy shit, like it's amazing, right? But for someone who was doing this type of work at Nike earlier on in your career, like what did that mean? Was that a moment for you? Was it like, holy shit, this is crazy? Like, what you think when you saw it?
Oh shit, I'm gonna get in trouble. Just, you know, I still, like I said, I love that place, man. It was where I really learned a big part of my craft. So it's a brand that will always, and not just the brand, the people, the brand who shaped me and created me and who I was. I'm always very respectful, deferential, and most importantly, you know, I still admire the work that comes from that place. So the big part of me that's like, oh shit, this is big. And it wasn't big, you know, from my perspective, was more, I've always liked my partnership with Nike. I've always liked the fact that we've done things together. So I didn't want it to ruffle any feathers, because I've always, and like I said, I still love the brand.
And you still have amazing relationships over there.
Yeah. To the highest level. So my first feeling was that once I got over that, which took me all of, like, I think a week and a half just to kind of absorb it, I got a little bit like, for all of the motherfuckers who said I couldn't do it, it's like, you know, because there were people, you know, you had salsa where you left with people like, he'll be back.
Absolutely.
He'll be back. Give him a few months. Give him a year. He'll be back knocking on our door. And
which, by the way, were some of the same people asking me for a job when I was at Beats, but we won't. This isn't about me. This isn't about me. We'll leave that alone.
Please do.
You know
please
who you do. Are. You know who you are.
Please do. Please do. Leave that alone. I have no clue what you're talking about. But at the end of the day, it felt like if I ever had sort of a stamp saying that it's real and you were actually able to, because, you know, again, you've heard Jay-Z say it. It's like if, you know, you could make a better Jay, make a better Jay. Like,
yeah.
It was, you know, if I'm so indispensable, then redo it. It was great for me to see that I could redo it, that I could go and create something that felt as big as a company that I admired for so long.
And from the ground up.
Yeah.
Right? Like, at Nike, you're working in a company that's been in existence 30 years and is worth, at the time, probably $20 billion. Yeah. You know, going over to Beats for a company that was 5 people and worth probably $50 million or whatever it was worth at the time. You know, to be able to see that, you know, I know for me as your friend, you know, was like full circle, was like really, I knew what it meant for you, just given, you know, how you feel about that brand and the work you've done and the relationships you have there and how you feel about the brand you're currently at. So, you know, I always try to do this, you know, kind of in closing, I always try to do this when I have people on this show that have been super successful and but are still grinding, you know. To that, and there's a reason why this is one of the first questions I asked you, to that 17-year-old kid that might be in Brooklyn and has zero fucking clue what he wants to do with his life, or maybe does know what he wants to do, maybe does see you in a magazine or has heard you on a panel or is listening to the show right now and thinks to himself, you know what, that's really cool. I like sports or I like music and I like creating, I like telling stories, but I have no clue how to even start.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what advice do you give to the 17-year-old you?
Yeah. What I would have loved someone to say when I was younger was, number one, find mentors. Find mentors who are successful and who exemplify what you want to be. So when you think about, you know, guys that you want to be like, guys who have a job that is similar to what you want to do, do what you can to find them and find mentors. And when I say find mentors, I think, you know, I get a lot of guys who come to me like, oh, please mentor me. And what most people don't realize is mentoring is really, when you ask someone to mentor you, the pressure really comes to you, because they're going to tell you things to do, and you have to be able to make some progress on those things before they'll give you more information. So, you know, you always get the help me and I want you to mentor me, but people don't realize the work that comes with that. So I think you find, number one is finding a mentor. Two, do not, you know, people tend to think a mentor has to be older than you. I've got mentors that are older than me. I've got mentors my age. I've got mentors younger than me. I've got mentors that I could be their dad. And at the end of the day, it's you find mentors who are successful in things that you want to do, and you find unique ways to connect with them. And, you know, what you'll you have to pick a craft. Like, what's your craft going to be? All too often, I hear people say, I could do this, I could do that, I could do this, I could do that. And it's like, when you say you can do that, which I did it when I was young. So, I mean, think about what I just said. I was a pre-med major who sold mixtapes on the weekend. And I probably did a few other things along the way. And I didn't really get the idea of a craft. Now, what was amazing about all those things is I was always sort of being very curious, learning and storytelling, which helped my craft. And I tell people I started late. Like, I started late on my craft. But once you get your mentors, pick your craft and be the best person at it. You know, like LJ says, like, do what you do and be the best at it. So don't approach everything like, I can do this, I can do a million things. Focus on what you really want to do. Leverage your mentors to help you get there, and then listen to them. I don't think I knew how to listen until I reached my late 20s. You know, I spent, and I know a lot of you who are listening to this do this, you sit there and you listen, and you're trying to figure out what you want to say next. And whenever you're figuring out what you want to say next, you're not listening. And I had to learn to listen, and that took some time, because I sat in rooms frustrated because I wanted to say something, never felt like I had a voice, never felt like people would listen. So I spent so much time, doorbell just rang, hold on.
We're live in the podcast.
This is going to be interesting to see what pops up.
Housekeeping, what's
going on? The door closes really fast.
Hello? Oh, we're fine. Oh, okay, thank you. It's good service here, man. Good service here. Toronto.
Again, just learning to listen and making sure, again, really listening. So I'm not trying to figure out what you want to say when you listen to your mentor, but really listening. And I say the last thing I would say is really learn how to finish. I don't know if everyone struggles with this, but I struggle with it in my career. You go back to school, people kept saying he has great potential. A lot of that just means I wasn't finishing. You know, I could get an A, but I was getting a B because I was starting to study late, which means I didn't finish. And learning how to finish was really important. So finishing, listening, having mentors are some really important things. And then the most important thing is craft. We live in the information age these days. You can get access to anything. You can look at Ad Age. You can look at, there's tons of trade publications out there. There's tons of websites that focus on marketing. Every brand puts their marketing out there for consumers to see and for you to evaluate and figure out how to do it. So there's really no excuses if you focus on an idea and you take some direction from a mentor. There's a lot of information out there, way more information than I had. Again, when I was a kid, I thought Nike was a big factory and the most senior guy, you know, had the clipboard and said, you come in at 8, you come in at 6, you come in at 5:30. I didn't know what being an executive was, what a CMO was. So these days you can learn those things. A lot of those things live on the web, and, you know, it's about spending less time in social media and looking at the transient stuff there. And looking at this classic business cases online that you can read, see what the results were, see what the business did, see where they failed, see where they succeeded. So a lot of information lives out there. And I just think any kid who wants to do the things that I've done or beyond, and by no means am I saying that, you know, I'm super successful, but the means are out there if you focus. Because I think the curse of it all is there's so much information. There's so many different things you can choose from that people tend to not focus.
Right. So I think, you know, all of that is obviously spot on. You know, I have two more questions for you and then we'll wrap up. You know, one is kind of a double click on what you just mentioned in terms of finding mentors and you know, the focus or whatnot. What do you say to that, you know, we said the 17-year-old. What do you say to that 22-year-old kid that's out of college that has his resume nice and shiny and is coming and he's, you know, puts on his best suit and he just wants a shot? What do you specifically, Omar Johnson, CMO of Beats, what are you looking for in terms of young talent? Is it school? Is it experience? Is it volunteers? Like, what are you looking for? What are your flags in terms of this kid's got it and this one doesn't? Is there anything specific you look for?
It's a great question. I think every individual is an individual. So some individuals are people who are going to come up to you and be very packaged and be very smart and be very articulate. There's some talent who may not be able to package themselves, but they have great instinct and you can tell they're capable of great work. So I can't say there's one rule, What I would say is if you are that person and you're interviewing with me or someone who does what I do, depending on the job you're interviewing for, know the job that you're interviewing for and be able to speak to how you can be the best at that job, which may mean taking a job a little bit smaller than you think you're capable of. Take the job you know you can kill, and then you can grow. I tend to watch people stretch their experience and get into jobs where they can't really handle it, and you know, failure just doesn't work well. It doesn't bode for a long track record. But I would say, tell someone your narrative, tell someone your story, make sure your story makes sense in terms of what they're looking for. I always think people should know the fundamentals. So if it's a marketing job, know the fundamentals of marketing. You know, do I expect you to bring it up every day? No, but know things like the 5 C's, 4 P's, learn Porter's forces, learn how to do a SWOT analysis. Those are tried and true sort of marketing things that everyone should be able to do. Now, is that going to get you a job? No, but knowing that you know those things, we know we have a foundation to build on.
That's a good point.
It can't be, I just have dope ideas.
Right.
Because dope ideas without the foundation don't always work. So I think there's your narrative, there's you demonstrating that you've mastered the fundamentals and you know some of the basics of marketing, and then I think the last thing is being able to articulate why you would be the best at this job.
That's good. I actually had someone ask me, literally was interviewing 2 weeks ago, someone, and you know, I asked them if they had any questions for me, and the young lady asked me, yeah, who wouldn't be great for this job? You've told me what you're looking for, who wouldn't be great? I just thought that was a really interesting way to come at it, where it made it very personal. Like, I know what I'm good at, like, who wouldn't be good at this job? So again, to your point,
and not every job is made for every person.
Absolutely.
You should be able to identify things and say, you know what, that's not for me, and believe in yourself enough to know that you can move into something that is for you.
Absolutely. So in closing, what do you, you know, here we are, it's May, almost June. Jesus, time's flying. We're almost halfway through the 2016, which is crazy. It's an Olympic year. You know, short, you know, you have a minute. What are you really excited about in the future, whether that is the rest of 2016 or just in general? What are you personally excited about?
Oh,
or should people be looking out for?
Yeah, it's less about to look out for, because hopefully we're everywhere and you don't have to look for us as a brand. You think about, you know, what we're kind of calling the year of sports. There's an amazing sort of run of sports, starting with the NBA Finals, into the Euros, into the Big Tennis Opens, into this event's going to happen in Brazil, to preseason of the NBA, NFL. So I'm thrilled about the fact that there's this really nice cadence of big sporting events, and obviously sports is something we take very seriously. What I'm excited about now in marketing is, I think, you know, there's been a lot of cool, innovative marketing things that have been done. User-generated content campaigns like Straight Outta Compton, or really cool websites and apps and things that have been built for consumers to use. I really feel marketing is getting back to some of the essence of what marketing was, and a lot of it's going back to what happens at shelf, what happens at stores, and the consumer experience from that level. Because all of these things can happen online and digital and on TV, but what ultimately matters is where that person takes the money out of their pocket and says, I'm buying this product. So I'm thinking about everything from sales associates and what they can do to merchandising. I'm looking for big ideas in that space, because I think that space, especially in my category, needs to totally be redone. And we brought a lot of innovation to the category before, but I think there's so much more that can be done. So I'm excited about that. I'm excited about what we're doing in other countries. So much of our business is here in North America. As you know, I love to travel. Travel is really important to me because it teaches you to learn. And, you know, for my whole life, I've been a minority. So I've always got what it feels like to be a minority. But to go and experience those different cultures are always amazing and thrilling for me. So as our brand grows, we have to go into those other places, be it Asia, be it Europe, be it South America. So, you know, our brand has an enormous ability to kind of grow overseas. So I'm really excited about that also. I mean, we made our first rugby commercial last year. And we've never talked about rugby before. You've been a part of every sports conversation. We've never talked about rugby. We've done stuff in tennis. We're looking at things like cricket. So when you think about how we connect with consumers, we're looking at doing it in a much broader way. We feel like we've done a lot of great stuff in the major sports. Now, how do we look at, you know, all the other sports that resonate around the world? So we also have the ability now, you think about the dream of the company, it was all about kind of fixing the music experience through distribution and headphones and devices. We're at the world's most amazing company to do that. So when you think about our ability now, you know, every headphone is connected to what? An iPhone. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in that iPhone is Apple Music and iTunes. So we actually now have the full ecosystem bought together, and we're still figuring out how do we bolt those pieces together. So again, really amazing opportunity for us as a company to get back to the original vision of the company, which was to fix the music consumption experience. So, you know, as I sit here and talk about it, I mean, I get excited because it actually feels like another startup. It feels like a whole another company that needs to be built. But those are things that I'm excited about now.
I love it. Oh, where can people follow you? Where on Twitter, Instagram? Do you remember your handles? What's
my Twitter's my name. It's Omar Johnson, and I'm
working. Still haven't figured out how you made that happen. We're going to talk about that offline. How you were able to secure Omar Johnson on Twitter?
I have no clue how I was able to get that done. And okay. Then through we made some phone calls, some friends on Instagram. I'm Omar_Johnson. But I'm working on Omar Johnson for Instagram also.
So by the time you hear this, that probably has changed to Omar Johnson, but try both. Oh, thanks for being here, brother. First time on the show, hopefully not the last. Got to get you back on.
All day.
Definitely the first show where LeBron calls in the middle of it and says, hey, let's go do brunch, guys. you know, an hour and a half. Brunch, after, amazing brunch. An hour and a half after we started. 3 hours, you know, real time, where we got some brunch and mimosas and sangrias and some shopping done and all that good stuff. I know you got a flight to catch. We'll do it again in L.A. Appreciate you. Thanks for coming on. We got to do it again.
All day.
Peace.
No problem.
To modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.